This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Let us recapitulate last week and then move forward. The important point that we established last week is firstly that there was only one act of creation. God created only on the first day. Everything else after the first day, with a few questions which we'll deal with as we move through the creation, but primarily there was a creation only on the first day. Everything else evolved out of that creation. So as much as you'll find that Orthodox Jews will show themselves to recoil from any such concept as evolution, the fact is that there was evolution. Not there might have been evolution, there was evolution. There's no question there was evolution. What there wasn't is it wasn't chaotic evolution, it wasn't evolution by chance, it wasn't purely survival of the fittest. It was designed by Hashem, it was directed by Hashem, orchestrated by Hashem all the way through, but the process was an evolutionary process, not a creative process, other than the first day. The second thing, of course, that we find impossible to accept in the theory of evolution normally is, well, not impossible, but certainly in terms of the literal reading, the time it took. We've got the creation taking 7 days, and yes, we could discuss and there are all sorts of theories how these were days were before there was a sun and the moon. The sun and the moon are only created on the third day. So what does it mean that there was evening and there was morning before there was sun and the moon? Clearly it wasn't the same concept. Let us recapitulate last week and then move forward. The important point that we established last week is firstly that there was only one act of creation. God created only on the first day. Everything else after the first day, with a few questions which we'll deal with as we move through the creation, but primarily it was a creation only on the first day. Everything else evolved out of that creation. So as much as you'll find that Orthodox Jews will show themselves to recoil from any such concept as evolution, the fact is that there was evolution. Not there might have been evolution, there was evolution. There's no question there was evolution. What there wasn't is it wasn't chaotic evolution, it wasn't evolution by chance, it wasn't purely survival of the fittest. It was designed by Hashem, it was directed by Hashem, it was orchestrated by Hashem all the way through, but the process was an evolutionary process, not a creative process, other than the first day. The second thing, of course, that we find impossible to accept in the theory of evolution normally is, well, not impossible, but certainly in terms of the literal reading, the time it took. We've got the creation taking 7 days, and yes, we could discuss, and there are all sorts of theories how these were days were before there was a sun and the moon. The sun and the moon are only created on the third day. So what does it mean that there was evening and there was morning before there was sun and the moon? Clearly it wasn't the same concept of time as we have today. And the Sikruna says something very similar to that. Let me see if I can find it for you. The Sikruna actually comments on the fact that time then and time now are not the same. That's the Sikruna.
Yeah, I think you need one.
Afal Pi says in this Pasuk in the fifth verse, Afal Pi Shelo Hayo Az Zman Ha'or VaHachoshech Misnaheg Al Oiso HaOfen SheMisnaheg Etzleinu Hazman. Even though the sequence of light and dark at that time was not the same as light and dark in our time, Shalu Kurim Atol B'Shem Yom B'Shem Laila. What we call night and day and what was night and day then is different. So that Sipruna gives us the opening to say maybe a day then was a billion years. Maybe a night was another billion years. That's possible. It's not very difficult to say that that's the case. I said that discussion is of interest to scientists. It's of little interest to students of the Torah. It actually doesn't make much of a difference if it was 6 days or 6 billion days or 6 billion years. It doesn't make a difference. It's not less miraculous. It's not less wonderful. It's not easier to understand if it took billions of years than if it took 6 days. It was a miracle in any case. What difference does it make how long the miracle took? The miracle is not in the timing, the miracle is in the act of creation. So the long discussions about whether the billions of years or whether it was 6 days, as far as I'm concerned, is irrelevant from a discussion of the Torah point of view. It doesn't make a difference to my life whether it was billions of years or it was 6 days. So why not accept it as it's written in the Torah in terms of my understanding is concerned? From a scientific point of view, obviously we have to look at all sorts of other things. But from an understanding of the Torah, there's no difficulty in saying it was 6 days. What exactly was the day? We don't know exactly what the day was, nor is it very relevant exactly what the day was. So there will be a difference between the evolutionists and ourselves, firstly in the sense that that was just a survival of the fittest process, whereas according to us this was God's design and God's nurturing and God's orchestration all the way through. And as we'll see also, whereas evolution sees the human as a natural progression and a natural evolution from what went before, we don't. But there was an element of creation in the human being that we'll come to when we get there as well. That the human being did not evolve in the same way as all the other animals evolved one from the other, not so the human being. But one thing is clear, that Ramban said last week, that the act of creation, what was created, was a single atom. An element consisting of the most simple atom was created, and from that everything else came. One atom was created in the material world, and another atom, so to say, was created in the spiritual world, in Shamayim, and that atom built the whole of Shamayim, and this atom built the whole of Oretz, of the land, and that was the act of creation. We further learned that there are two views, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemia, as to whether matter was created first or energy was created first. And we said, if we accept the principle that there was only one act of creation, then it's not a question of which was created first, it's a question of which was created. Because if energy was created, then matter evolved. And if matter was created, energy evolved. So we saw that already in the Medrash, written nearly 2,000 years ago, there is a clear assumption of Einstein's theory. That either matter evolved from energy or energy evolved from matter. That's the only machlokes, is which came before, which was the first and which was the second. And we saw in the reading of the verses how you could read it both ways. Either that in the beginning God created heaven and earth, and then he said, let there be light, so that the light was a creation and a development from heaven and earth. Or, in the beginning when God created heaven and earth, the first thing he said was, let there be light. And for light, obviously, we're talking about energy. Light is energy, and that was the first act of creation. Now, moving in a little bit further, we also commented on the Yerushalmi, which is based on the Zohar and other places, that the Reishis also means, it comes from the word Rosh. Rosh does not only mean the inception, Rosh also means the head. Head indicates the intellect, and therefore Bereishis, that days at the beginning of the Torah, can mean God created in the beginning, that the days can be in, the days can be with. If you use an implement, God created with Reishis, or God created using Reishis, but Reishis was the raw material. And we learned last week that Reishis was the raw material. That Reishis, meaning intellect, God's wisdom, was the raw material from which he created the energy. So that what we're doing is we're extending Einstein's formula one step further. Not only does matter come from energy, and that's a massive step, but energy comes from wisdom, which is also a big step, but not as big as Einstein's step. If matter can come from energy, energy can come from wisdom. That when we look at wisdom, and this is the most important part of last week's shiur and this week's shiur, because this gives us an understanding of the role of Torah in the world and what it is and how we function with it. We're too used to thinking of Torah as one of the branches of human knowledge. And we're too used to thinking of knowledge and insight and wisdom as an activity. You know, you swim and you eat and you think and you sleep. It's not that at all. Thinking is a completely different realm, and wisdom and insight is a completely different realm. The wisdom of knowledge, particularly innovation, is a source of energy. That when one innovates, there's a source of energy. And that energy, the fact that there is a linkage between innovation and energy, is something we know intuitively, if we'll just use that intuitive knowledge. When my father first became a rabbi, I was a young man from yeshiva. They don't teach you how to speak in yeshiva. It's one of the failures. In modern yeshiva, they don't even teach you how to just communicate one to another. In the olden days, in Lithuania, so they used to teach boys how to communicate, how to talk, but they didn't make public speakers out of them. There wasn't a homiletics class. So when rabbis came out of yeshiva, they started off not necessarily being able to speak all that well. And my father, as some of you heard, and later became a very fine speaker, was not a good speaker, I'm told, when he started off. And one of the ways that he became a good speaker was, he used to tell me, every Friday, after he'd spent hours and hours preparing a talk for Friday night, and he only used to speak for about 10 minutes on Friday night, the chief rabbi in South Africa, was a man by the name of Rabbi Rabinowitz, used to call him every single Friday, and used to say, right, tell me what you're saying tonight. And he used to have to say it over to him. And he would say, usually his main criticism was, so what's the chiddush? What are you saying that's never been said before? And that's a terribly challenging thing. Every single week you come up with something not that you've never said before, that has never been said before. And once my father was really in a corner, it was nearly Shabbos, and whatever he said, the rabbi says, but that's been said and that's been said. There's no chiddush, there's nothing new. And my father said, why does there have to be a chiddush? Is what I'm saying wrong? The rabbi Rabinowitz said, it's not wrong. So he said, do you think the people in the shul have heard it before? The rabbi Rabinowitz said, no, definitely not. Nobody's heard it. No, they weren't who heard it. So he said, so what's wrong? So for them it's new. What does it matter that somebody else said? And he then gave my father his most important lesson, and one of the most important lessons my father gave me. And that is, if it's not new to you, there's no excitement in the way you deliver it. And that won't inspire anybody. It's the speaker who needs the chiddush. It's important for me, and I've got Mr. Streit sitting over here who knows all 650 of the tapes that I gave in South Africa. My luck. Come to a new city, I thought I've got 650 shiurim ready to repeat. And every time I come close to repeating anything, he tells me, on Parsha such and such, 1982, that's what you said, or you said it differently, or whatever it is. And the truth is that even if Mr. Streit wasn't here, I would go out of my way as far as I could to say something new every time. I've given a series on the creation before. There are tapes available on them. I hope that they're different. I don't refer back to the tapes. I don't remember what I said in the tapes. I hope they're new and they're different. Not because it makes a difference to you, but it makes a difference to me. If I'm telling you something I've said before, I won't say it with the same kind of energy that I would if it's something that I've just conceived of this afternoon. There's a kind of a freshness, there's a dynamism, there's an energy that comes with new insight. When you grasp something new, there is an energy. And we're meant to be doing that all the time. All the time. When the Amiroim used to meet each other, the characters from the Gemara, the great rabbinic scholars, what they used to ask each other, the first thing they would ask each other, Ma chidush nishadish beveis hamedrash hayu? What was the new idea that occurred in your Beis HaMedrash today? That was always the question. What was the innovation? What was new? And it's very, very frightening that in today's Jewish world, for good reason, but still not excusable, for good reason, there is a fear of innovation. And the result of that is that yeshiva students and rabbinic scholars are discouraged from being innovative. And with that comes a lower energy level, and with that becomes a general dullness of intellect, of regurgitating the same things in slightly different forms and organizing them in different ways, managing the information rather than innovating the information. And yes, it's true that it's quite possible that if I were to repeat to you the shiur of somebody greater than me, that would be far, far more interesting for you. But it wouldn't inspire you as much as repeating my own, because of the style of delivery, because of the energy. And when people are communicating, the content is not the only thing that's important. What's important is the energy. And you would have had it in school yourselves, and your children would have had it, that their best teachers are not necessarily the most knowledgeable. The best teachers are not necessarily the ones that teach new material. You can have several parallel classes and tracks where the same textbook is being taught, the same material is covered, and the children write the same exams. And one class is inspired and the other isn't. When we communicate with each other, we've got to inspire each other, because any other form of communication can better be done by technology. If it's just a matter of communicating information, today you don't need people for that. Sit at your computer and you can access whatever information you want. but a computer cannot inspire you. Only people can inspire. And they inspire with their own excitement that comes from a new angle, a new insight, a new perception. And that's what keeps us vibrant. That's what keeps us energetic. That's what keeps us excited in whatever it is that we're doing. In our relationships, in our business, in our learning, in our reading, in our social relationships. If there isn't a novelty, if there isn't something new, there's nothing to get excited about. But when there is something new, there is excitement, and excitement is energy. So the transference of thinking, of new ideas, of creative thinking into physical energy is something we understand. And the transference of physical energy into matter is something we understand as well. So that a material world could have been created from God's insights, from God's wisdom, is something that logically is not incomprehensible to us. Now, if light was the first thing that was created, the Medrash asks, Rabbi Shimon ben Yehotzadak sho'al Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachman. Rabbi Shimon ben Yehotzadak asked Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachman, Omar Lehi, said to him, Mipnei she'shomati olecho sho'ato bal agodo. I hear that you're a thinker. I hear that you understand the abstract concept of the Torah. So perhaps you can explain to me, Meheichon Nivres Ha'ira. Where was light created from? Where did it come from? What is the question? Why doesn't he ask a question about everything? The whole 6 days of creation, talk about new things that were created. The only thing he asks about is light. The Al-Sheikh explains that if light was created from something that existed before, if it was created from the heavens, then it's not a creation, then it was there before. If it was created physically, then where did it come from? It doesn't say created, there's no Bria there. It doesn't say in the beginning, Bara Hashem Esaur, Hashem created the light. So there doesn't seem to be even an act of creation. So if it's a physical creation, where does it come from? If it's a spiritual creation, then it wasn't a creation at all, it was there all the time. Very interesting that it's on energy that the Medrash struggles. And says energy is neither spiritual nor physical, it seems to be somewhere in the middle. Where does it come from? Is this part of the spiritual world or is this part of the physical world? And our understanding of that goes further, because the Maharal speaks over and over again about the fact that light is the most present thing in the world, and the only thing that isn't in any way related to anything physical, material. So it's the least material and the most present. Because what can you see more clearly than light? And if there's no light, what is the value of everything else? You cannot engage with anything else. Imagine if there was no light. Then whatever there would be in the world would be worth nothing. You wouldn't be able to use it. You wouldn't know where it was. You wouldn't know what it looked like. You wouldn't know how to handle it. We would know nothing of the world. So our knowledge of the world is a function of light. So not only is light in its own brilliance the most present thing that ever is, light makes everything else present. And yet it's not physical. It doesn't have a physical form. So light, energy, becomes a source of major fascination to the Chazal, to the rabbis. And they say, where was it created from? Where is this energy? The other things we can figure out where they fit in. There are material things and there are spiritual things, and we can understand where they fit in. But where does energy fit in? Where does it come from? And the answer is even more amazing than the question. Amale, he answers, Melamed shenis'ate po HaKadosh Baruch Hu kasalmo v'hivik ziv hadoro misof ha'ilom v'ad sof. God enveloped himself in it like a cloak and radiated it from one end of the universe to the other. So what is that light? It's Hashem himself. Energy comes from God. That's the source of energy. And that can be turned into matter, and that can evolve into all the different forms of physical things that we have. But energy as such, that comes from Hashem himself. When it says, God said, let there be light, let there be energy, that was part of him. So when we say that Bereshis, that the world was created with intellect, and the intellect was turned into energy, what we're saying is God's thinking, God's ideas, God's wisdom turn into an energy, a source of power, that initiates everything that takes place in the world. Look how far off science is. As close as they're getting in every area, as we commented last week, the one thing science will always battle with is the origin of the Big Bang. What started it? Because that requires a religious answer. And science can't go that far. Science can only start after the Big Bang. Then science can take over and can figure out exactly how it all happened and what happened. Can figure everything out. Can recreate, the Kuzari says, science might even be able to recreate the human being. To create a human being genetically. It wouldn't be a big deal. Once the formula is there, you just have to discover it. But what science cannot figure out is how it all started, that initiation it cannot figure out. And look how far of it is. What are we looking to try and find that source? We're trying to find some explosion somewhere, we're trying to find some star somewhere, we're trying to find some piece of a star somewhere, something that might have hit it off. What it was Hashem. There's nothing else than that. That was God Himself taking a part of His energy and turning that into physical energy that in turn became physical matter. So now we have an alignment between God Himself, God's wisdom, and energy. Let's go further with that. The Torah is often called light. Torah or no mitzvah, the Torah or Torah is light. Hashem is called light. Hashem Uri V'Yishi, we say every morning and every evening now and ever. Hashem Uri V'Yishi, God is my light. And we used to think, or sometimes we think that that's just an image. Light is clarity and God is my light and the Torah is light. That's not what it means. Torah O means Torah is a source of energy. Hashem Uri means God is a source of energy. If we want to energize ourselves and energize the world, what we've got to link into is Torah and God. That's where our energy comes from. The rest of the world, energy is fixed. That was all science and discovery. You can't create more energy. You can't create more matter. And the totality of matter and energy is fixed. So if we want to energize, the only way we can create energy is from within ourselves. We can energize ourselves. We can't create physical or material matter, we can't create. But to be energized and to create energy, that we can, but we have to access God and God's wisdom, and that means creativity. What does it mean to access God's wisdom? When are we thinking like God? When we're creating. If we're merely regurgitating things that other people have said, that's not thinking like God. Thinking like God is when we're thinking with Chiddush, when we're thinking with an element of creation. So God reveals Himself to the world in the opening sentence with what word? Bereshis, using intellect, bara, there's creation. And that's what God is. Using intellect, there's creation. And what is the creation? Energy. And what can you do with energy? Anything you want. That's what being godly is. And to live a life that is uncreative, to live a life that is monotonous, to live a life that is boring routine in one's thinking, in one's being, in one's essence, is living an ungodly life. You can wrap it up in as many talisim as you want, but it's an ungodly life. Godly when it's continuously changing and growing and developing and new, that's what it is. But people find that very scary, because when God set about to create the world, well, He knew what was going to come out because He was God. He had a blueprint because He was God. But when we start creating, we don't know what comes out. We just take a chance sometimes, and sometimes what comes out is exactly as we want it. Sometimes what comes out is a lot better than we ever dreamed it could be. And occasionally it comes out a bit of a mess. And then you fix it. Doesn't matter, you fix it. And it comes out right eventually. There's such interesting studies that explored the early supremacy that Toshiba gained in the laptop market. And the way they did it was by not trying to be perfect. By making them and getting them out as fast as possible with all their flaws, and getting the customer complaints and learning from the customer complaints and modifying and improving. So by the time the next card, I don't remember who it was, came out with their first laptop, Toshiba was on their 10th generation already. Did Toshiba have a lot of angry customers? Yes, they did. But they got over it. They replaced their computers for them. They sent them nice letters. So their angry customers turned to loyal customers, and they had the market already. Sometimes if one tries to embroil oneself in the design phase for all of one's life, designing this perfect thing that one will never build, that's not godly. Bereshis, in the beginning, What was it? Take a new idea and borrow, create, make it work, do something with it, implement it. That's what the creation is. That's what the Torah is. Take wisdom, take a thought, take an idea, take a vision, and make it work. But that means you start with the future. And that's what creation is. Well, how can you create without starting with the future? And does that mean that time existed before God started? Well, maybe it does. That now becomes an interesting question. Was time a creation? Or did time exist before the creation? Now, I have always taught that time was a creation. And with that, we can answer all sorts of difficult things and unpleasant things, like the old conflict between God's predetermination and free will. And you can say, yeah, well, there's only a gap between predetermination and free will if there's time. Isn't that right? If there's a before and an after, then you can say, how does God know what I'm going to do tomorrow? But if in God's world there is no time, then there's no question. So, and since time was part of the creation, in God's world there's no time. All very simple, very nice, philosophic, and it all becomes very neat. Except if we say that creation requires the implementation of a vision, then what you're saying is, when I create, I see something that doesn't yet exist. When God created, did he see something that didn't yet exist, or did he just make a big bang and say, let's see what happens when you put these two chemicals together? Maybe light will come out. That's not what happened. God had the vision complete, every detail of the vision. That means the creation, the present, follows the future. And that's an idea of Rav Yoshe Ben Soloveitchik, one of the most important principles that he taught in part of his brilliant work that so few people learn because it's so difficult. And it's one of the most rewarding pieces of work to learn. It's a rewarding piece of literature, it's an even more rewarding piece of philosophy, it's still more rewarding piece of psychology, and it's the most rewarding piece of Torah. Rabbi Soloveitchik's Isha Halakha, where he describes the halachic personality and talks about the fact that there is no eternity without time. There is no time without eternity. And that in the Jewish world, the future and the past both direct the present. The present is not directed only by the past, and the future is not the outcome of the present. The future directs the present. And you start with that vision of the future, and that determines what you do in the present. And that's the essence of Bria, which means God must have had, there must have been time in the very beginning, before God even created. There must have been a concept of time. Now, where would there have been time? There were no clocks or watches, there was no sun, there was no moon, there was no night, there was no day. Where's the time? But I'll prove to you that there was time before. Look in your Chumash, it says it very clearly. Notice, whenever God creates something, what does it say? Such as in verse 3, in verse Gimel. God said, let there be light. Create light. And there was light. And so you can go on in each day. You go on to the next page. And God said in verse 6 in the first line, let there be a firmament. So there was a firmament. And in verse 9, let the waters beneath the heaven be gathered into one area, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. Let the earth sprout vegetation, herbage yielding seeds, etc. And it was so. So whenever God wanted to create anything, it said, let there be. Yehi, let this happen, let there be. But look what happens in verse 5. God has already said, let there be light. He divided between the light and the darkness in verse 4. And in verse 5, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening and there was morning. When did God create them? It doesn't say, let there be evening, let there be morning. It said, and there was evening and there was morning. Where did it come from? Okay. There must have been evening and morning before, says the Midrash. Yehi erev ein kesiv, says the Midrash. It doesn't say, let there be evening. Elavaya here, and there was evening. Mikan, from here we learn, Shehoyo said as manim kodem lechem. There was an order of time before the creation. An amazing concept. So amazing that the Rambam says it's absurd and it's nonsensical. Says the Rambam in the Maran of Ochim. Don't take it seriously. It's not one of these midrashim that must be taken literally. Of course, nothing existed before the creation except God himself, and it doesn't mean that at all. He says that's the view of Aristotle and others, but it's not the view of the Torah. and don't take that medrash seriously. But many do take that medrash literally. And for our understanding of Bria, we need to take it seriously. If we're saying creation is Reshit, it's taking God's wisdom and taking that wisdom and transferring that, implementing that, and creating something real out of what? Out of a vision of what will be. Then there has to be a future in the present, which means the concept of future, present, past existed before the creation. Now the Rambam of course is right, nothing existed before the creation except God. So what does that tell us about time? That time is part of God himself. That God is eternity, and as Rabbi Soloveitchik says, there can be no eternity without time. Can't have a concept of eternity without time. Eternity is the merging of past, present and future into one moment, into one unit. That's eternity. Eternity is not just the span from the beginning of time to the end of time. That's one view of eternity. But there's another view of eternity. That is, in every moment there is an eternity. There is the possibility, there's a yesh kone oiloma b'shoachas. A person can achieve the entire universe, everything he needs to achieve in one fraction of a second. Because in a moment there can be eternity. What are we meant to be? Where are we meant? What space are we meant to occupy from a time point of view? When we think, for example, of the mitzvah at the end of last week's Sedra, to remember what Amalek did for you and to wipe out Amalek. Where are we at that moment? We're going back in history. It's here, Mitzrayim, coming out of Egypt, remembering Amalek and what he did to us, remembering the mitzvah into the future to wipe Amalek out so that Mashiach can come into a clean world where there isn't an Amalek. There's an entire span that goes through your mind at one moment. At that one moment, that's where you live, that's the space you're occupying. Whether it's Pesach that we're in, or Rosh Hashanah that we're in, all the time we're expected to occupy a space, a time space, that is far greater than the present. It's a space that includes the past from the beginning of time, from Bereshit, to the end of time. And that's where we're meant to be. So we've got to understand time in a much more sophisticated way than just the passing of moments. But clearly, and we'll try and understand it a little bit better, the concept of evening and morning, the contrast, the movement from dark to light and light to dark, that is something that is inherent in God himself. Maybe we go further and we say, so the Al-Sheikh discusses and says, well, what does it mean God created light? If light was God himself, then what does it mean by a Hiyar? Says the Al-Sheikh, that's what the Gemara, the Medrash, is asking. When the Medrash says, where was light created from? What it means is, if light was God, then why does it say, and God said, let there be light? You are light. What is the Vayehi Earth? Says the Al-Sheikh, God had to dilute the light. He had to make the light a little more coarse, because otherwise it wouldn't have been able to function. We wouldn't have been able to, it would have been just too brilliant, too bright. The world couldn't have functioned with the light as it was. So Yehi Or was not the creation of light. The Yehi Or was in fact the creation of darkness. The Yehi Or was the creation of the contrast. The Yehi Or was the dimming of the light so as to make it usable for the world. That's really what it was. The light was there all the time, says the Al-Sheikh. It was the creation of a veil over the light that could make the light something that could be workable and something that could be usable. God's capacity to withdraw and therefore to create darkness and to come back and to create light and to move backwards and forwards, to create time by the pulse of light which was his own. If light was there all the time, because light is God, and God's ability to create light, to give off light, or to withdraw the light is there all the time, then there was a pulse to that light as well. That's what the Medrash means. We shouldn't think of the time before the creation as a time where there was just this bright light burning all the time. There was a pulse. The pulse of life is not something that God created. The pulse of life was God himself. And that pulse was evident. You could see it. It wasn't just a static light. There was light and there was dark, and there was light and there was dark. And where did the pulse took billions of years to happen? From light to dark and dark to light, or took moments, and it was a pulse like a heartbeat? We don't know. But what we do know is that there was a pulse, and if there was a pulse, there's time. You cannot have pulse without time, you cannot have life without time, you cannot have time without a pulse. And that energy, if we're now developing a picture of that godly energy, it's an energy that pulsated with life. An energy that was sometimes there and sometimes wasn't. There was mystery to it. It was sometimes in its full force and sometimes it was withdrawn. And that's what God created and made usable right in the very beginning of the act of creation. Now let's go a step further. There is a particular dimension of God's wisdom that he used to create the light. What was the wisdom? Well, the Gemara says, the Medrash says, Kabbalah is brought, Bischus Gimel Dvorim Nivra Ha'ilam. The world was created because of three things. Bischus Chalo, Bischus Maestros, Bischus Bikurim. What were the three wonderful things for which God created the world? What, this whole vision, this whole creation, what was it for? Three mitzvahs. Taking challah, when a person's baking her challah, she's got to take a piece off, and now we just burn it, but in the days gone by we would give it to the Kohen. It's one mitzvah. The other one is maaser. When you buy an Israeli orange, you cut a piece off, and now we discard it, but in the time of the Beis Hamikdash we would give it to a Kohen, so that all the produce from Eretz Yisrael. And Zchus Bikurim, the first Bikurim, the first fruits, were also brought to the Beis Hamikdash as a sacrifice. Those were the three things. Why? What's special about them? Because they're each termed Reishis in the Torah. Chalo, the mitzvah of Chalo, is Reishis Arisoy Seichem, the first of your baskets of dough. Reishis is Maaser because it says Reishis Digancho, the beginning of your produce. And Reishis is Bikurim because it says Reishis Bikurei Ad Motzecho, the first fruits of your land. So when we have to give away from our first fruits and from our challah, the term used for first is Reishis, not Hatcholah. Not again, as we said last week, not the beginning in the normal sense, the normal word that would be used, but the same word that's used at the beginning of the Torah is used for those three mitzvahs. And the Gemara learns, and the Kabbalah is brought, that is essential, that's central to the idea of the creation. What's the connection? And if we go back to our last week's understanding that Bereshis doesn't mean for the sake of those three mitzvahs, but Bereshis, he used those three mitzvahs in the creation. What is the essence of those three mitzvahs? The essence of those three mitzvahs is that the process of initiating not ownership, because it doesn't apply to all ownership, but to initiating the rewards of growth. The process of initiation is gift, giving something away. The first fruits, what is the intuitive thing to do with the first fruits? Let me take them home and show them to the family and let's have a party tonight and celebrate. No. First fruits, give away. You keep the second lot. The gancho, first wheat that comes, the first produce that comes, give away. You keep the second one. Normally people say, when I'm on my feet, I'll make a donation. When I'm earning enough money, I'll start giving stock. That's not what it's about. Reishis. You start the process with giving away. You don't start earning and then give. You start giving and then you earn. That's the process. And so with challah. That challah, you start, what is the process of challah start? Challah start is the moment that a woman creates, or a baker, creates bread, creates dough. It's a new creation. That's the most fundamental production process. The first time, it's the beginning of technology. Bread production. Because you're taking water and flour, and when you mix them together, you haven't got a mixture of water and flour. The water and the flour react with one another to create dough. It's a new, it behaves in a new way. There's a chemical reaction that takes place between the water and the flour. So you're actually creating, out of many little particles of flour, many little grains of flour, you're creating one unit, which is now a mass of dough. At that point you have to give challah. It's not even edible yet. You've just created a new concept. Give away. Not big amounts, doesn't have to be big amounts, but give away. The action has to be given. What differentiates the generous from the miserly is not how much they earn. It's how early they give. That's the difference. How much they earn is a quantitative measure. How much they give is also a quantitative measure. The biggest donations are not from the most generous people. A person sometimes who's struggling and gives a small donation is being far more generous. The person is not struggling and gives $1 million. It's sometimes far more painful. For the person who's on a fixed salary, struggling to pay his bills at the end of the month, to say, but I'm going to give. That's far more painful and far more miraculous and far more heroic, very often, than the man who writes the $1 million check and it doesn't really matter. And yet, who do we give the cover to? Who gets the honor? The man who gave $18 and it was really tough, or the man who gives $1 million and it was nothing? we flip over to $1 million, of course, but that's not what it's about, what Reishis is about. Reishis is about the dynamic. Is the dynamic one of first give and then consume, or one of first consume, and when I've had enough, and my children have had enough, and there's more than enough, we'll give some too. That's not generosity. And so the chokhmah, the wisdom, that production is the outcome of generosity, not the outcome of selfishness, is the wisdom of God and the wisdom with which the world was created. Because God starts the process by giving. The Reishis borrowed. There was nothing to give. What did God have to give? There wasn't the world. He wanted to give something. What did he have? His own energy. That's all he had. So he took his own energy, and from his own energy he made a universe. And he said, that's the wisdom I want you to live by. Take your own energy, the energy you put into the challah, the energy you put into the fields, the energy you put into your fruit trees, the energy you put into your businesses. Take your energy and create with it, make with it, inspire with it, give others with it, make other people happy with it. Create something for others that they don't have. That's what the Bria is, that's what creation is. So when we say God created using his wisdom, what is the wisdom that God created? Something uniquely godly. That is the wisdom that production is a function of contribution, not contribution is a function of production. It's the opposite of what anybody would think, but that's God's wisdom. And so Bereshis Bara Elokim, in the beginning God created Reishis using his wisdom, the Reishis of Truma, the Reishis of Maisa, the Reishis of Chalo, the Reishis, the initiation, not the way the linear kind of initiation that we would normally consider, but a completely opposite kind of initiation. Just as we said, here you begin to see the paradoxes of the Torah. And when you begin to understand this, the Torah becomes a book so exciting that you don't want to put it down. You started off thinking that the future is an outcome of the present. No, says the Torah. The future designs the present. The present is led by the nose, by the future. And so you'd better have a picture of that future, otherwise you don't know where you're going. You're going to create that future in the present. And if you don't create it, it won't happen. You'll sit around waiting for it. You can see the future, do it, make it. That's a new idea, it's counterintuitive. And the second thing we learn, in the first sentence of the Torah, we think that giving is something that comes after receiving. No, receiving comes after giving. What can I give if I've got nothing? Nobody's got nothing. Everybody's created in the image of God. We've all got energy. Give your energy. If you've got nothing else, give your energy, roll up your sleeves, take some time, and give energy. You can do that, everybody can do that. And the energy can translate into other people's energy. Energy can be multiplied. Multiplied energy can translate into value, into matter, and all of a sudden things are happening. And that's how one starts a business, is it not? What are all these startups? An idea? Some very hard-working people, and some of them then dupe other people into giving them money, and some of them actually create ideas that are brilliant, and the ideas start generating money. An idea starts generating money with nothing else, just the idea and hard work. That's real. That's the creation, that an idea can generate your value, that an idea, that the way we think with each other, the way we deal with each other, the energy we invest in one another, that can generate value. One begins to understand why midos are so important, why character and personality and relationships are so important. Because if the creation of value is all about transmitting ideas, then barriers to that transmission destroys value. And if there isn't a good connectivity between people, if people aren't transmitting their value fluidly, their thinking fluidly, then of course value becomes destroyed. Nothing can happen, nothing occurs, despite whatever energy there is. That ties us back to what we learnt last week with the Aleph days. Starting with Taf, you remember, and I won't take you through the Taf, Shin, Reish, Kuf, and all the rest of it, but let's get right back to the beginning. You remember, Beis came along, and God said, Beis, Brocha. That's a good letter to start with. Because what is Brocha? Brocha means creating plenty where there isn't. Brocha means overflow. Brocha means creation. Brocha means giving. the creation, the origin of the Torah, the source of the Torah, the machine that drives the Torah is Bracha. I don't care what else Bayis stands for. The fact that Bayis stands for Bracha, there is no better letter to start the Torah with. And he starts with Bayis. But together with creativity, there needs to be another element, the absence of which destroys the impact of creativity. When the creative person becomes arrogant, he loses his capacity to have any further impact, and he stops creating. And so the vital sustenance of creativity is humility. And it's the link between the two. For the creative being to retain his humility is fundamental. And so God brings the Aleph into second place. Because Aleph is the silent letter. Aleph is oneness. Aleph recognizes that all creative power comes from one, comes from God. People don't initiate creation. God initiates creation. We just link into that energy and we transmit that energy and create. But if the link between us and God is broken, we're nothing. The moment that link is broken, we're nothing. So we have to understand all the time, as we create, that we are really channels of creation from God, that God is the source of creation and the master of creation. And then you don't have to be a loudmouth about everything. If you're truly creative, you don't have to shout about it. The people who have to talk about what they're doing are the people who need to feel their impact by other people's response rather than by the creation itself. When you're truly creative, you don't care whether anybody is there to applaud it necessarily. The act of creation itself is so explosive. It's when one isn't involved in anything creative. When one is busy imitating, and when one is busy packaging, and one is busy shifting things around from one place to another, and recycling old ideas and old things, the only excitement one can get is the excitement of marketing the idea, of making a big noise out of the idea, and making people think it's new. But when they take it to pieces, they realize it's nothing new, it's nothing spectacular. When we are dealing with the truly spectacular, we can afford sneers, we can afford humility. Because the truly spectacular can be very quiet. The truly spectacular does not have to make a big noise. And so Aleph comes into second place. If we're dealing with sequence, if we're dealing with a present that has a future, then the first Rashi begins to make sense. I'm not going to go through it in detail, we don't have time. But merely to point out that Rashi asks the famous question of why the Torah doesn't start with the first mitzvah. If the Torah is a book of mitzvahs, the first mitzvah is the law of Rosh Chodesh. And that only comes in the second book, in Shemos. Why doesn't the Torah start with the law of Rosh Chodesh, which is the first mitzvah? And even though we need to know that God created the world and so on, we know that in the Ten Commandments. Because I am the Lord your God, who took you out of Egypt, and I created the world in 7 days, and that's why you keep Shabbos on the seventh day. We're told that, we know that. Don't need the whole story. And everything that happens afterwards, with the flood, and with and Noah's Ark, and the Tower of Babel, and Avraham, and Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Yosef, and his brothers, and the whole, what do we need it all for? Give us the mitzvahs, give us the bottom line. And Rashi says that the reason is that if the non-Jews should ever say to the Jews, you are robbers, you have stolen our land, give it back. Can you imagine the non-Jews ever saying such a thing? Could conceive of such a time when the non-Jews will say to the Jews, give us back our land. Our answer is, God gave it to us. But there then has to be recognition of God in the whole process. But more than that, there needs to be a recognition that people come and go from their land, that land ownership is not permanent. That the Italians own Italy today, but it used to be the Romans, and there's no real relationship between the Romans of old and the current Italians, nor between the current Egyptians and the old Egyptians, or the current Greeks and the old Greeks. They're different nations. They've gone. The old ones have disappeared. These are new nations that have come. Lands, civilizations come and civilizations go, and they don't always stay on their land. And when we study the Torah, we learn what causes civilizations to lose their lands. Civilizations lose their lands when they lose their civilization. Civilization loses their land when they lose their morality. And that's the story of the Torah. To understand the rise and fall of nations based on their moral structure rather than on their military fitness. But that's what creates permanence. That's what creates security. And that's what creates something that is lasting. And so if we understand the whole of the Torah from the very first verse being the teaching of sequence, the teaching of causality, the teaching of taking a future and seeing it in the present and taking the present and projecting it into the future, and understanding that the causality we're looking at is moral causality, not the causality of physics and not the causality of politics and of history, but to look at moral causality, how morality, the morality of individuals and of nations determines their future, that's the study of the Torah. And that's why God starts with this. I created the world from nothing, and I made certain conditions for its occupancy. You want to live on the earth, these are my conditions. Keep the conditions, you can have the world. Break the conditions, you'll lose the world. Those are the conditions. I'm the creator. And that's how God introduces himself, without getting into great scientific detail of how he created the world, which is not very relevant. But what is relevant is that he created the world and why he created the world. That God created the world is the first thing we need to know. Why he created the world is the second thing we need to know. How he created the world is totally irrelevant. And what do we spend our time on? Civilization. That he created the world, science doesn't acknowledge. Why he created the world, science is not interested in. All it's interested in is how he did it. How he did it is not relevant. The only things that are relevant is that he did it and why he did it. And that's what we need to be teaching ourselves and our children over and over again. It's God's world. He made it. Here are the conditions. And look what happens when we keep to those conditions, and look what happens when we don't, over a long period of time. We don't always see it in short periods of time, but over a long period of time we see it over and over again. The demise of nations who don't abide by the conditions of creation. And so we'll see as we move next week through the second and the third day and there onwards to lay the foundations of the rest of the story of civilization. Thank you.